Good evening and welcome to a special presentation of Boise State Public Radio News. On February 11th, KBSX hosted four panelists and members of the public for a discussion on the state of police and community relationships in Idaho. Police-involved controversies in Ferguson, Missouri and New York City last year served as the impetus for our discussion. Panelists included Boise Police Chief Bill Bones, Ada County Sheriff's Office Captain Steve Bartlett, Boise State Criminal Justice Professor Andy Giacomazzi, and Leo Morales of the ACLU of Idaho. A reminder, a recording of our forum is archived at boisestatepublicradio.org. We began our discussion by asking panelists to address the state of law enforcement's relationship with the public in Idaho. Morales responded first.
Well, community relations with regards to law enforcement, the community across the state, I would say is a little bit different in different places. And that's as a result of different factors. One, including how open of a communication there is between the law enforcement, whether that's county, whether that's city, and their community as well. There are certain communities that I would say have better relationships than others, and so I think it varies by region. At our office, we tend to see a little bit. I mean, complaints are all over the place, to be honest with you. We're starting to see a little bit more of a rise from North Idaho with regards to community members and their local law enforcement. So again, I think that the relationships are a little bit different, and there are areas, of course, that I think that. That are concerning as well, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that and what areas community members are expressing concern about with regards to the relationship between the law enforcement and their community.
Dr. Giacomazzi.
I think you're going to get annoyed with me very quickly as the professor. I got to say that I think, relations here in Idaho are probably pretty good, but we don't know a lot in terms of systematic data collection. What Leo is talking about is very passive ways of finding out the relationship or the state of relationships between police and citizens, and we don't in the state have any systematic process to gauge these kinds of issues, whether they are issues of police and citizens collaborating well with one another, working well with one another, or the opposite. And so we do rely on things like what Leo was talking about here in Boise. We rely on Boise City Ombudsman. The news on that is that over the last 10 years, complaints with regard to the Boise Police Department have gone way down. But again, only one indicator of many that can be used to systematically figure out whether the state of police community relations are going up or going down. I surmise they are doing better these days, at least here in the Boise area, than they were, say, 12, 15 years ago.
We'll come back to that. I want to follow up there after we hear from Chief Bones and Captain Bartlett.
Let's start out just to say a little bit from a foundation standpoint. I spent a lot of time talking with law enforcement leaders across the nation and looking at what's happening in other departments and communities, and the good and the bad. And while I won't say we're unique, it's very, very unusual, the relationship in the Treasure Valley that we share, especially here with Boise and our citizenry. It's something that hasn't come around by accident, and we weren't always in this position. And if you look back 10 or 12 years ago, we might have been medium at best, and some people would have argued poor, but we've really learned a lot of lessons in transparency, that community engagement, involving the community in the decisions we make and being a part of the police department, made huge strides, and I couldn't be happier with the relationship that we currently enjoy, although that can change quickly on sometimes an issue that you're not aware of, and so it's constant attention, and especially looking at those groups within your community that might not share that level of trust and relationship with the police department.
Captain Bartlett.
I think the key word that you bring up and that you hear from the other members on the panel is that word relationship and that word trust. And I think that's one thing that the Ada County Sheriff's Office has worked extremely hard on over the last number of years, is that trust and ability for us to be transparent and show what we're doing. It's very important for us to get in front of the community with events like this or town hall meetings or homeowners associations. And so I think those relationships here for us at the sheriff's office are very good with our community. We work really hard on that. And I think that's what you see across the nation. You don't really experience or have an opportunity to know what that relationship is going to be like until You have a tried and true or tested experience like we have in St. Louis. And so we're doing everything that we can do on our end here that when those situations arise, that we have the relationships and the trust built with the community that we're ready to put our best foot forward.
Dr. Giacomazzi, you have done research specific to the Treasure Valley, but it's been, refresh my memory, about 10 years.
It's been about 10 years, yes.
Is there a danger in not always knowing, not always having a sort of a pulse on this relationship?
I don't know if it's a danger. It's just something that in this era of policing that we're currently in the local agency sees here exhibit this very well, this idea of problem-oriented policing, community-oriented policing, intelligence-led policing, all referring to this idea of really proactive problem-solving. It's not a danger as much as it is a missed opportunity to really get that pulse of the community in a real systematic way. Short of that, we have a lot of anecdotal evidence. It feels like there is a good police community relationship, certainly in the Treasure Valley. I would not argue that whatsoever. The last citizen survey that I know of from Ada County was in 2004. The last one in Boise PD 2007. Fantastic. To be honest, most police agencies across the country don't do these at all. It's probably time to think about follow-up type surveys to not only see where that baseline has gone. I would imagine it's probably gone up because we've enjoyed a lot of successes here, again, locally in terms of police community collaborations, partnerships, all the good things that the Ada County Sheriff's Office and the Boise Police Department are doing. But I will say one thing. These surveys are really good in the sense that you can, if you have a large enough sample, you can drill down to neighborhood levels. So you can see, as Ada County did with their contract sites in 2004 and as Boise PD did in 2007, you can drill down and say, well, you know, at the organizational level, things are going well, but what about in a particular neighborhood, right, where things may be a little bit different? And that allows for data to be used by the police department, by the community, or the sheriff's office to really solve problems that may be a brewing.
One thing we figured out in researching the discussion tonight was that there's just very much so a lack of local data, state data, even in Idaho. Of course, in the last 6 months, 8 months since what happened in St. Louis happened, there's been a wealth of national data. And I'm going to talk about some of that and getting into a discussion about attitudes across the country towards police and how that might affect the job that law enforcement here in the state of Idaho does. A Gallup poll taken in December, so only about 8 weeks ago, I think, showed less than half of Americans feel like the honesty and the ethical practices of police are high or very high. The figure of 48% represents actually a 20% drop since 2001. It was the lowest rating in 20 years. Also, back in August, right after the shooting in Ferguson, a survey by USA Today showed two-thirds of respondents saying police departments nationwide only do a fair or poor job in holding officers accountable when misconduct occurs. So I don't know how many of you have followed this particular situation, but there was a shooting yesterday involving a police officer in Pasco, Washington, in which a man was killed outside a store that serves the Latino community. And this is a report that came down in our system today from Anna King of the Northwest News Network. And I want to play this for you.
YouTube video shows several police officers running after a man across a crowded intersection. Some bystanders caught the incident on cell phone footage and posted these clips. A man appears to have his hands above his head as he's running away, and then he faces officers with his hands raised before the shots come. Residents of Pasco say now they are nervous. I spoke to this man who was afraid to say his name on the radio.
It's upset. We have kids. We want them nice to live in peace, everybody. And I just don't feel comfortable to go to the stores. You know, just not even driving or seeing people. It's so scared. It is.
The Washington State Patrol is investigating. I'm Anna King reporting.
It's the kind of thing, I see you grimacing, Chief Bones, and I would imagine it's the kind of thing that was 300 miles from here. Ferguson was, 1,500 miles in New York City, the situation there, all the way across the country. Does that make your job, even though that's not in your jurisdiction, does that make your job more difficult to do?
Oh, any type of, and not to know that there's any type of misconduct. First of all, anytime there's a loss of life, you've got such an impact. You've got an impact to that person's family, whether it was a shoot that should have happened or shouldn't have happened. You got an impact to the officer, and you got an impact to the community. And if it happens to be a shooting that shouldn't have occurred, or the officers just didn't act to the level they should have in professionalism, it affects everybody. There is no individualism in departments in the way they're monitored and held to a standard by the communities that they live in and evaluated, because we live in a national and international media age, and something that happened in Pasco, Washington, or happened in Florida yesterday, you read about it, you saw it on your Facebook last night, you saw it in the national news, and you're seeing your friends email you those stories. That reflects on law enforcement across the nation. And so you have to build that account, that trust account with your community on the service you're providing, because there are going to be those incidents that are going to happen. And they may happen in our community. We hope that they don't, but they may happen in our community. And I think it comes down a lot of that to the perception of your community. Are you policing your community? And if you're so, that's wrong, because you're not policing a community. You're providing police services to a community. And it's really a way of thinking. Are you working with your community and you're deriving the power and influence that you're exerting to make change and make it a safe community from those you work with? Or are you thinking that you're working over? And when you have that bank account with a community, they will understand and recognize that you do things differently. They may look, and there may be a few people that say, okay, all police are this way, but that's a very small percentage. Most people look fairly and they say, how have I been treated in the community in which I live? So we're judged a little bit and held to that higher count. It does have a negative impact, but by working better and having that communication and doing the highest level of service that you can possibly provide to the community you serve, they'll take that into account.
Let's use that as a point to transition to a discussion about race. Idaho is a very homogenous state, of course. We're mostly white in the state of Idaho. There are pockets of the state where we're not as white. And I think here in the Treasure Valley, the closest example probably being in Canyon County. Leo, I want to ask you a question about, from the ACLU's perspective, how police across the state of Idaho interact with members of minority populations.
Sure. Well, at this point, I mean, Idaho, I would say, is no different with regards to the rest of the country when it comes to race relations. I mean, with regards to, again, the first question, too, right, the communication, the state of the communication between law enforcement and their community, while it was in certain circumstances, there's a good relationship, what we need to do is break it down further with what community, right? And that's a fundamental question that I think that today hopefully we'll get into discussion, because as we saw from that reporting and what we've seen across the country, the relationship with law enforcement in certain communities is different. And I think that's at the heart of what we have in this country, is that we haven't necessarily dealt with the issue of race. And the way that we've dealt with it has not been productive. And so there's lots of work that needs to be done, including in the state of Idaho. I mean, we continue to see, if we were to take per capita numbers, we in the state of Idaho, we continue to see more African Americans, Latinos that are being arrested, apprehended, convicted, as compared to the white community. And that is a systemic issue. It's an institutionalized issue. It's a structural issue that, as a society, we haven't dealt with yet. And so, you know, that again, is that the Ferguson is, what happened in Ferguson essentially are incidents that could also happen here. And it's a matter of time. Who knows if Pasco would have thought that it would have happened in their communities, but it did. And so I think when we talk about this issue, we have to realize that the relationship with certain communities is different, and that is the same case in the state of Idaho. At our office, we get numerous complaints from across the state. They're different, and that's not just about law enforcement. Most of the law enforcement that we tend to get, the topic complaints, of course, are alleged racial profiling. But we also get complaints about public defenders, for example. You know, there was one particular case up in North Idaho where it was a Latino community member, and the public defender essentially told him, you know, you better plead guilty because no F brown person is going to get a fair deal up in this particular county. There was another instance in the Twin Falls area. This was an African-American male. Same, the public defender told him to plead guilty because, you know, individuals like you are not going to get a fair trial in this community. And so, you know, those stories we continue to see across the state. And so when it comes to the relationship, really, we need to break it down, because in the state of Idaho, just like in many other places, that relationship is just not there yet.
One of the major knocks on the Ferguson Police Department was how poorly it reflected the local community. It was a
relatively speaking, a very African-American community, while you had a very white police department serving that community. This is a question I would like all of you to weigh in on. Is law enforcement in Idaho diverse enough? And if it's not, for the first two gentlemen, how do you change that?
I can start. Absolutely not. No, we're not diverse enough. And it is a struggle constantly for law enforcement. And this is a conversation among chiefs, no matter where you go, is how do I attract a more diverse department? But you have to attract a diverse applicant pool. And it is very difficult. If you walk down to the last BSU test, and we'll do all of this work, and Dr. Giamazzi will know this, I walk into the room, and I usually try to go down and see these tests, and I'll look around the room, and I've got 90%+ white male adults in that room taking that test. I have a few minority groups, and I'll have two or three female applicants. And that is, so we're actively trying to draw that in. But it's essential to reflect all elements and constituent groups within a community. And it's not just race. It's if it's your sexual preference, it's the religious background, the cultures of the community that you police, because it goes to that communication piece. And what Captain Bartlett was talking before about establishing trust within a community. And if you don't have the communication, there's no basis to establish a trust. And so we're probably not going to be able to achieve that in the short term in Idaho, no matter what police department you're in, to completely reflect the community. But it should always be something that we are working and striving to achieve.
Captain Bartlett, what are your sheriff's office's vulnerabilities because you are not diverse enough?
Well, I think just by the nature of the times right now, I was just a part of a discussion today with our human resource department where we are really struggling with getting applicants into our pools for just general hiring. The Ada County Sheriff's Office is having a tough time, and all police departments across the state are just by nature with the economic times improving, we're seeing far less people apply for our jobs in general. And so when that's a problem overall, that shows that it's not a minority issue or a cultural issue, it's an economic issue. And when we deal with that as a sheriff's office and as a police department, I think those numbers will improve. We absolutely see that as a work in motion. We want to have officers that are of the same ethnicity as our population that we're working with. We want to service the citizens that we work with on a daily basis to the highest level possible. And so I wouldn't say that it's a shortcoming or a problem. It's something that we definitely want to make sure that we're providing those tools necessary when they become available, and we're doing what we can to work with that.
Dr. Giacomazzi, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this topic from an academic standpoint.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've mentioned already is that many of our law enforcement agencies in Idaho are really engaged in problem-solving policing. And when we think of problem-solving policing, we often equate that with solving problems out in the community, which is true. But these problem-solving departments, Ada County, Boise City, as two examples, try to problem-solve internally as well. And so the fact that they are progressive in thinking about representation, their workforce matching or mirroring the community, is a lot more than I can say for other police departments. Ferguson is one example where they are now, after the events that unfolded in Ferguson, now talking about trying to have a more systematic, strategic attempt to get African Americans in the police department. That proactivity is very, very important because, as the chief said, good police community relations can be fleeting, and they are not always, even when there are high numbers reported in surveys, not always, as Leo said, are they representative of all groups in that jurisdiction.
Leo, if Idaho had across the state a more diverse set of police officers, do you feel like the number of complaints, the types of complaints your office gets would be different?
A little bit, but not too much, I would say. I think there are two things that we need to address. One is, of course, just the representation itself, right? So getting, whether it's the case of Canyon Canyon or even Boise, getting community members that are from the refugee community that would be law enforcement or Latino community, same in Canyon County. So one is actually having members from the community that can actually work with law enforcement. So that's one. It's actually getting the staff there. But the second problem that I think is also very important that often doesn't get addressed is actually it's not just about putting a brown person or a black person in the law enforcement. It's actually changing the institutional culture as well. I mean, that's part, again, where we get to more of the systemic reform that's needed in this country, not just in Boise, Idaho, but in the entire country, is how do we deal with systemic reform? Because even if you have a law enforcement that mirrors the community, if the culture isn't changed, a Latino man is still going to go out and arrest another Latino man because that individual is alleged to be a drug dealer or whatever it may be. And so part of it, I think, is also not only the people representation, but also the systemic changes that we need to make. I think it's extremely important that law enforcement at all levels of government have training, significant training around this issue of race, around this issue of implicit bias. The reality is we're human beings and we carry biases. And so, and there's numerous, there's video footage out there. For example, one that was recent of a community member. So this was from a dash cam, a police officer's dash cam. The officer was white. The individual that he was recording was an African American, right? Some of you may have seen this go through Facebook, but essentially the officer is watching this gentleman. The gentleman leaves, pulls into a gas station, and then the officer, of course, follows. The camera is on, and the officer gets out. The gentleman is already out. The officer says, "Can I see identification?" Right, so something to that effect. And what happens is the next thing we notice is African-American male tries to go back inside to his vehicle to try to get what he was asked for, identification. Next thing we notice is the law enforcement is shooting him. He's down on the floor, and one of the last things that we hear is the African-American community members is asking, "Why did you shoot me? Why did you shoot me?" And again, that is an example of implicit bias. And the reality is, you know, our law enforcement are placed in situations that are dangerous, and sometimes you're potentially trained that certain folks are more dangerous than others. So because this gentleman was black, there's a possibility that the law enforcement thought this person is probably going to reach for a gun, but the reality, that's not the case. And so I think the point is that we need to do systemic reform. Training needs to be done differently so that the law enforcement also reacts differently to the community that are supposed to be protecting as well.
Let's shift gears and let's talk about the militarization of police departments across the country. That was one thing that came up out of the Ferguson situation. The police response in the St. Louis suburb put front and center this issue, and it's an interesting issue, I think, because it very much applies to Ada County, to Boise, and also Congressman Labrador from here in the state of Idaho. Of course, he introduced a bill back in September in reaction to the reaction from the Ferguson Police Department to try and do away with the military program that is sort of essentially a hand-me-down program that's taking ex-military equipment and putting it in the hands of agencies like the Ada County Sheriff's Office. And Congressman Labrador, I'm going to read you a quote here from the release from his press office. It said, "Our nation was founded on the principle of a clear line between the military and civilian policing. The Pentagon's current surplus property program blurs the line by introducing a military model of overwhelming force in our cities and towns. Our bill would restore the focus of local law enforcement on protecting citizens and providing due process for the accused." Captain Bartlett, I'm going to ask you first. The agency that I think is most visible with the MRAP, the armored vehicle, here in at least the Treasure Valley, is the Ada County Sheriff's Office. Why is that something you feel like your officers need?
Well, I think it's critical to the safety of our citizens and to our officers. When speaking about Labrador's bill that he has presented, we at the Ada County Sheriff's Office feel that is not appropriate or a safe way to approach the military equipment that the federal government has available to us in law enforcement. A good way to look at that is we at the Sheriff's Office put a Riva, an armored rescue vehicle, into service in 2012, around May of 2012. And we have since then used that vehicle approximately 10 to 12 times for the purpose of keeping our citizens, keeping our officers safe, But the other big thing that we use that vehicle for is educating our public, taking that vehicle out to service events, taking that vehicle out to schools, town hall meetings, homeowners associations, and really educating the public that in these situations where a vehicle like our Riva would be needed, and we had one of your family members or one of our officers in a critical situation where we needed to reach that family member and bring them to safety so we could get them to the hospital and get them the medical care that they needed, that rescue vehicle allows us to take that vehicle downrange in the middle of gunfire or whatever that critical situation is and rescue that person safely and get them to immediate care as quickly as possible. And so we at the Sheriff's Office feel that that's a critical piece of equipment that we could never afford without that situation. Most of those vehicles, when you look across the board, most of those vehicles, when they are put into manufacturing, cost about $250,000 up to $500,000 for us to put those in service. And what this federal program from the military allows us to do is to get that vehicle at no cost to the citizens of Ada County. And with our labor, we put that through our shop. Our mechanics did all of the work on that vehicle, and we were able to put that vehicle into use. And just 2 weeks ago, we had a critical situation, and some of you may have seen that on the news out in CUNA, South County, where we had a female that we went to a call on where she was shooting gunfire out the windows of her house, at the neighbors, at our officers, and we were able to take that Riva and put that shield between our officers and the citizens in that gunfire that was coming, and we were able to get those citizens out of that street and into a safe environment. And so for us, that's critical for us to be able to provide that service to our citizens.
In preparing for our discussion tonight, I sat down with your boss, Sheriff Rainey, who we actually could not talk out of a Caribbean vacation to join us tonight. So we did the next best thing. We sat in his office and we had a really nice conversation, and he actually discussed, I believe, that particular situation, which I think is the most recent dispatch of that vehicle.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to play you what he had to say about that and why he strongly defends the use of this vehicle and the chance to use it.
There's a woman in the second floor of her house shooting at us. We were able to use that vehicle to protect the deputies who were there on the scene, who were protecting the neighborhood. It's not the vehicle. It's the use of the vehicle. We use it responsibly. We use it to protect the deputies. We use it to protect the community. Ferguson, I think, misused it in the way. Having it in the background or if something really went wrong, that was safe. To bring it out in the way they brought it out with rifles on top of it was idiocy.
It's a very strong word, not one I'm sure he throws around very often. Leo, your organization, we talked beforehand in preparing for the discussion tonight, and your organization has some concerns. Sheriff Rainey says this is just another tool. He talks about when he was a police officer, a patrolman, he had a gun and a nightstick. And he said that pretty much limited how I could react to a specific situation, essentially saying the more tools, the better off officers are. This is another tool. What is your organization's concern with the militarization of local police departments?
Sure. We have major concerns with regards to the increased amount of the militarization of law enforcement across the country. And I mean, this conversation, all of us should really step back on, because it isn't necessarily just about the tools. It's about fundamentally altering that social contract between law enforcement and its community. That's what's fundamentally at stake here, is that relationship that exists. And when we begin to bring military weapons into our communities and use them, whether you know for good reasons or other reasons, or begin to use them more often, you know that sends a different message to the community as well. The ACLU did a national public records request of many law enforcement offices, and we didn't do one here in Boise, I'll be clear with that. But what that information showed us firsthand is that many of these vehicles, military weapons that are being used, particularly with the SWAT teams, are now being used for what used for primarily warrant So, and they're primarily, and I think we believe it was close to 80%, 79% were used for search warrants. And out of those, it was about 62% that were used for drug warrants. And so what we began to see is that, well, if our local law enforcement have these, if the tool is there, they're going to be used. And so different departments have different policies, and that's also one of the areas that we as citizens, as community members, need to see is what does the policy look like in communities? Because when there is no checks and balances, we're all in trouble. And so with regards to the increased militarization of law enforcement, we're very concerned about that, and we agree with the congressman in this particular area. And so while it is a tool, again, it fundamentally alters that relationship and that trust between the community and its law enforcement. I'll just read one quick quote that was going around during the Ferguson scenarios, and it says, there is a reason you separate the military and the police. One fights the enemies of the state, the other serves to protect the people. When the military becomes both, the enemies of the state tend to become the people, right? So again, this really is a quote that puts us back and really allows us to have this fundamental conversation about what does it mean to be more heavily militarized in our community.
Dr. Giacomazzi, I think you have something to say.
Well, I think first off, the term militarization of the police sometimes makes this sound more than what it actually is. We still have civilian police departments, over 100,000 of them across the United States at the local, at the county, at the state and federal level. The militarization of policing is really getting at the surplus equipment that police departments and sheriff's offices are using these days. And unless you can make the argument that they are using tanks now to pull someone over for a regular traffic violation and not something that is used in specific instances for the public safety, the police officer's safety, I'm not sure that a lot of us have big problems with this. This is not a military police. Police officers across the country are still operating under the principle of restrained use of force. That's the U.S. Bill of Rights and the landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases, mainly in the 1960s, that limit police and the amount of power that they actually have, but are using these vehicles, for the most part, for legitimate reasons. Now, one of the things that Leo said that I absolutely agree with, though, is that because of the nature of policing systems in the United States, we do not have a centralized police force here. So every department at the local, county, state, and even federal level, they have their own policies for the use of things such as, you know, what your uniform looks like, what your badge looks like, what the kind of cars that you drive, and the kind of military vehicles that you might have and uses for those. So that does need to, I agree with that, need to be looked at if this militarization is resulting in overusing the use of force that is legally prescribed to policing.
Chief Bones, forgive me. I'm not sure if the Boise Police Department has had a lot of surplus military equipment come its way. Is there some on your roster?
We've had a significant amount of minor military equipment. Do have one emergency response vehicle that is surplus from the military. Similar vehicle was $450,000 that would be parked in a field rotting if it wasn't being used here. It's been used twice by the Boise City Police Department.
In how long?
In probably 6 months. Since we obtained it. Maybe it's been 8 months since it got outfitted and ready to go. That's been used twice. Both of those were instances where we had explosive devices located in residences. Those, on one occasion, we actually asked one of our fellow agencies to supply a second vehicle, and that was able for us to provide a shield around that house. That particular house was next to a school. We had an elementary school across from it, and we would have had to evacuate the entire school. Being able to use those vehicles to put in place to give that protection, and in those cases, it really wasn't for the officers. The bomb squad was forward. It was for all of the citizenry that would be a significant distance away. Would like to touch on just a few things my colleagues marked on. Absolutely, military and police are two separate entities, constitutionally and socially in America. We've made that decision, and that's the right decision. And when we talk about militarization of police, I think the issue does often get clouded. The key thing is, as Leo said, the 98% most important part of this is the mindset of police departments and understanding that they're not a military entity and they're not policing over a community. They're working with that community, as Dr. Giacomazzi said. That's the key to avoiding militarization of police. It's how those policies, those cultures exist within police departments. Now, I feel these tools, these are just tools, and it is how you use those tools. And I absolutely agree with Sheriff Rainey. The use of those tools for crowd control in Ferguson and the message that sent inflamed that situation and were completely the wrong thing to do and have destroyed much of that trust, as we talked about how that can affect here in Boise what happened somewhere else. That destroyed trust in our populace of America. And it's driven a good discussion. And these are the kind of conversations we need to have. But I do believe those are a useful tool, and they're a great asset to have to protect not just officers, but even more importantly, our citizenry. That said, if the citizenry of a given community decides that that is not something they want their police department to own and use, then the police department serves the community, and that's the community input that should be taken in that decision. But it should be taken with an open mind, where a police department, a government entity, lays out the reasons why they have those tools, what the uses are, and it's a reasoned decision on their use.
To follow up on one of the points that Leo made, is there, Chief Bones, a danger, a blurring of the line between military and police when a local police agency has in its tool belt, if you will, a machine that was made for war as opposed to community policing?
I really don't think the tool is going to drive that problem. I think where you drive that problem, and I'll tell you, I believe it happened in Ferguson, was over a decade ago and losing that relationship with the community, losing touch with the community they were serving. Those relationships got destroyed years and years ago. That isn't something that happened over a tragic shooting. It was absolutely tragic what happened. That was just a flashpoint that triggered something that had been laying under the surface, because there was no interaction, real interaction, between that police department and their community. There was just going out, we're going to answer calls, but it wasn't the engagement that you need.
I'm curious, and feel free not to respond if it's not something that you're comfortable with, but this is an issue that fascinates me, and I'm personally curious to hear where you folks stand on it in the audience. How many of you have heard Leo's response and would tend to align more with that as opposed to that of the, okay, first, okay? And then the others, mm-hmm. who would choose to maybe side more with those from law enforcement? So maybe 60, 40, 60? Very interesting. Let's shift gears. I keep looking at my watch. I promise I'm not bored. I just want to. We have a lot to get to, and there's a lot on the radio that we promised that we would discuss. So I want to get to that. We're going to shift gears and talk about the use of body cameras, something that's been in the news here in the Treasure Valley for the last year or so. Let's start with you, Captain Bartlett. The organization, you made reference to it already. This is a move that you have made a very deliberate effort to, a significant investment in resources in. Why is this something that's important?
Well, I think what's important to us as the sheriff's office is that culture that we build within our officers, and the culture that we build and the honesty that we build with our citizens in the population that we serve. And for us, transparency is huge. It's paramount in what we do as a sheriff's office, as a police department. We are no different than the public. We have been chosen by the public to serve you. We are public servants. And so I think it's always important for us to keep that in the back of our minds while we're doing our job. And so we've been assigned as police officers, as sheriff's deputies, and one of the ways that we felt as a sheriff's office that we could be a little bit more transparent and we could answer to the people and we could police ourselves by evaluating what we're doing on the street is by putting body cameras on our deputies. And we felt very strongly about that. Sheriff Rainey felt strongly about it, and we've always had video cameras in our cars, but what that limited us to was when we were not directly in front of our police vehicles, we as sheriff's deputies and citizens could not see exactly what was going on. And so by going live with our body cameras, it has allowed us the ability to follow that call from start to finish. We can have video as we're potentially chasing somebody down the street in our vehicle. If that changes out to a foot pursuit, we can then have footage of that completely. If it goes into a building, it just gives us the ability to be very transparent, to build that trust with the community, and for us to sit back and really look at, was this call handled properly? And so that was very important to us.
So we all understand what exactly we're talking about. Chief Bones, how do these work?
An on-body video. So there's several different types, but generally it's either mounted to your chest or on your shoulder or your eyeglasses. Small video, there's different ways. They have ones that'll take infrared, wide vision, or some that are tailored to look more what the human eye sees, so it reflects what the officer's seeing mounted to the eyeglass. So there's choices departments make in those. They're generally turned on or activated by the officer. Some of them are activated automatically with the lights of a car, depending on how they're programmed. They capture all of the video contact unless the officer turns it off. They're booked and able to be processed.
On all the time?
No. The amount of data you would capture if you left it on 10 hours a day, the storage of that data, the redaction would be phenomenally expensive.
So one of the joys of being in a job like this is to form an opinion, hear from one side and go, okay, that makes a lot of sense, and then to talk to somebody on the other side of the issue and hear a complete different perspective. Leo, when I sat in your office a week ago Monday, I thought, I didn't foresee there being any issue around the issue of body cameras, any concerns around the issue of body cameras. To me, it's more accountability, right? And I figure everybody would be in favor of that, but you do have concerns, and when I heard about them, I thought, they were also very, very interesting. What, from an ACLU civil liberties advocate position, is your issue with the body camera?
Definitely. Well, first of all, I mean, we believe that body cameras, body cameras, are an important way to hold our government officials accountable, right? So that's one. Two, we do believe, because, you know, at the ACLU, we also firmly believe in privacy. So this particular tool can also be dangerous if not used in a way that protects privacy as well, whether that's privacy of the community, because officers could easily be walking by it out in the public too, or in a private setting and be recording, or whether it's in someone's home. Officers also have right to privacy as well. So depending on how a police station drafts their policies and procedures, that's what's at the core for us and our concerns. So for example, if one concern would be if law enforcement is given unlimited discretion to turn off or on or off a camera, that could be pretty dangerous, because when it's not to their benefit, it might go off. And so I think there needs to be very clear guidelines of when it turns off, when it goes off. Two, I think is making sure that we protect the privacy of officers as well. So in areas where, for example, if they have to be on all the time, officers, you know, are living human beings, and sometimes they're having a conversation with their colleagues, and it's a friendly conversation or whatever it may be, and it's being recorded, we have to be careful with that as well. But I think that one, again, is unlimited discretion is a concern, making sure that the privacy rules that are drafted are good, that protect not only the community but also the officers as well. I think if you give the authority for the officer or the department to do editing, that could be concerning as well. And then how you store someone or how someone accesses that information is also could be another area of concern as well. So I think, you know, there are various areas that there would be concerns with cameras. But in the end, we believe that as long as the right policies are in place, this is a good tool that could be a win-win for the community, because, you know, not only does it allow us to hold officers accountable, but it also allows the officers to hold the community accountable. I think one example that we had from Canyon County was this a few years ago, the shooting of the dog, right? And so the community member was very mad that the officer shot the dog. But once the video was released, the community member realized that the officer was within his right to actually shoot that animal that was attacking him. And so the individual wanted to apologize. So it's a win-win situation, but really it's how we draft the policies as well.
Right. There's an introduction of technology, and then oftentimes there's a learning curve, a reaction, then sort of some of those regulations come in. For the two gentlemen in law enforcement, Where does that stand at this point? Are you almost always crafting, you know, new policy in regards to body cameras as you learn and real life experiences get factored in?
So Boise's been using audio recording for over 10 years. We've had it for 20 years, but it's been mandatory on most of our contacts, any enforcement contact, arrest, for the past decade. We haven't moved to the on-body video, and this is where Leo and I are on exactly the same page. We've been evaluating systems now for about 18 months. Actually made a call to the president of one of the companies this last week, asking him, one of the challenges we had was the privacy issue, especially in victims and witnesses' homes. And that, you know, that video being played maybe for a suspect that they don't want, or the public asking for that, and how do we provide that privacy? There's also the major redaction issue of trying to redact all of that to what we can give out when somebody makes a public information request. And we had asked, hey, we should have the ability when you go into private home to turn that to an audio only, or at least that somebody has that request. So that was a request we actually made from one of the major manufacturers of on-body video. I see this as where law enforcement is going because it leads to better accountability. It leads to better transparency. I think it'll decrease complaints and increase public trust because they see actually what happened. Now, a camera doesn't show everything from different every angle, and its perception can be very different, so that's something we all have to take in mind, and there's some great videos to watch that show you that. But they are a fantastic tool for law enforcement. We just given the number of recordings we make on our department. If we started tomorrow and started submitting those, we would overwhelm the criminal justice system in the disclosure that they would have to make in the redaction. So we're really trying to work towards that. I see that happening in the near future. But we would love to see legislative change within the state of Idaho. We'd like to see Idaho lead the pack across the nation in recognizing the privacy of victims and witnesses and giving some protection to them so when that video is collected that isn't automatically something that's given out and requested.
Last thing I wanted to touch on tonight is the issue of homelessness in the city of Boise. The Boise Police Department chief has taken some heat in the last year or so, especially last summer, for some of the actions taken against, with the homeless population, the west end of the downtown near the skate park. Here's an opportunity for you as a brand new chief of police to explain the BPD's policy towards Boise's homeless population.
Well, the homeless population, just like every population of Boise, is a population we serve. We're here to serve their needs and to make them as safe as we can within the community. And we have had some major safety issues at that particular location, as you're aware. We had a homicide. We've had several batteries, and there's some significant health issues. But the idea is not enforcement. Enforcement doesn't solve problems. Now, somebody commits a homicide, they go to jail, they go to prison, we do everything we can. But as far as the situation of being homeless, there are many, many aspects to that. Whether it's a substance abuse addiction, whether it is a mental health issue, whether it's a lifestyle choice, and people make those choices and they have that right. What we do have to do is balance that with the rights and the laws within the city, the ordinances of the city, and have an approach that takes all of those considerations. So the people that they're impacting, if there is somebody performing something that's against the law, whether that's the camping ordinance or littering or creating an unsafe environment, with the person that doesn't have a house or home to go to, it's helping to find a solution to the underlying problem, not treating the fact that you have, okay, the homeless in this location and you're seeing these issues pop up. It's what is causing the underlying situations. Whether that's the homelessness, the mental health issue, or a substance abuse addiction, there's a mix of people and we need to find solutions to the base problems if we really want to solve the bigger problem that we're seeing on the surface.
Leo, this is an issue the ACLU has been very active here in the city of Boise. And when we had our conversation last week, I sensed from you that the working relationship between the ACLU of Idaho and the Boise Police Department is very good, but that this is the one topic where things are a little bit sticky. What are your concerns?
Well, our concerns, again, the city of Boise is just, you know, not addressing the root causes when it comes to this particular issue. I mean, the sad reality is that we have one of our most vulnerable members of our society that need help. I mean, these are individuals that are oftentimes coming back from war. They're suffering post-war issues, right? I mean, and so, well, there are community members that lost their jobs, and so, but these are community members that essentially are very vulnerable. And the way the city of Boise has proceeded, at least what we've seen the last few years, is more towards punishing community members, sending them to jail. I mean, if someone, we receive different complaints. I can probably review some of those. But you know, where an individual, for example, is suffering from whether it's a disability or that issue should be addressed instead of giving someone a ticket or sending them to jail, and then that individual is eventually going to come back, and nothing has been solved there. All we did is continue to use tax dollars, to house that community member for potentially one day or a few days, but we haven't fixed anything. And that community is going to come back again, has no home, no place to go. I mean, there's been successful models out there, right? I mean, I think now we know the city of Utah, with their housing first model, has decreased the number of chronically homeless in the state of Utah, and I think there's successful models out there. But I just don't know whether the political will is here in the city of Boise. So.
Very good. Folks, it's 7 o'clock. I haven't seen a hand yet at this point, so got one.
Mike Levy, Warm Springs Mesa, Boise. This is an outstanding conversation we're having. And this is really small potatoes, but I wish the city of Boise would paint their new police cars a nice color. They are, I know they're not meant to be military vehicles, but they're kind of scary. I like the old ones that you used to have, so.
Well, I can address that.
We have to go.
No, absolutely. And I appreciate the input. So Boise City, we changed the color of the police cars here a couple of years ago. Anybody notice that? White and blue to the black Chargers. And it happened at the same time that we went from the nice long Crown Vic traditional to the new Chargers, which look like really fast, mean cars. I'll be honest, I objected at first. I was against, because the blue and white, that's the way I was hired 22 years ago. It's tradition, and I wanted it to continue. Not so much. And then I had concerns about the cars and the aggressive look. And the mayor, frankly, had concerns. And so we only created a few of those to begin with, and we sent them out. And I have to say I was wrong. I got amazing, overwhelming, I got 90% of the people that we talked with that preferred the cars, which shocked me, I must say. And since then, I still get complaints. I get a complaint probably, every week or two. Somebody will call in or they'll mention it to me in passing because I still ask. But I get more people that like them than not. And maybe I do notice the younger you are, the more you like those police cars. But it does concern me. It's a great point, because you don't want something to set you apart. And part of the biggest trick for police officers is getting out of that car. We've got to get out of the car, engage people face-to-face, whether that's on foot, on bike, in a business, at a community meeting, engaging groups that get that two-way conversation. So that's the biggest key, but I do appreciate the input.
My name is Eve. As you are likely aware, recently across the nation, there has been a concerning number of cases of unjustified termination and brutality of people of color and people experiencing mental health issues by law enforcement. Do you plan to implement any trainings or policies to combat this trend in our local police force?
Well, I can speak from the sheriff's office perspective. Absolutely, we recognize that issues are arising across our nation with regard to that topic. We take that very seriously at the sheriff's office, and so we provide annual training for all of our officers in-house, whether that be on culture, whether that be on ethnicity, and we take that very seriously. The other place that, to back up a little bit on the previous question, when we see that homelessness population and that demographic of our population that we serve, we don't see that a lot in the unincorporated Ada County area, but where we do see it is in our jail. And so we have taken a very proactive approach with working with our resources here in the community, with our Veterans Affairs, and with the various population groups that we service to put together a robust resource center that we, when dealing with that population, we can provide those resources at that time.
If you missed it, I'm sorry, the question was about drones, City of Boise, Ada County Sheriff's Office potentially buying drones.
The sheriff's office has looked into the topic of drones and looked into pricing and looked into the various rules and regulations that are set forth by the FAA on this topic. And so I can say at this point, the Ada County Sheriff's Office has no plan to implement that program.
I agree. There's some privacy concerns I have. I'm actually more concerned. We have no plans. I'm concerned about getting some ordinances and laws in effect to control the privacy of what's happening with the drones in private hands. We also need to have some balance there. Just wanted to touch real quick on the mental health topic. That is an enormous issue in our community, and you really can't overestimate the impact it has across the community. And Idaho is number 48 in mental health funding for our populace out of the nation, so we're way behind in that case. Boise City Police have been working very hard because we recognize that some of the most terrifying and frankly people that we have had to use deadly force upon have been mentally ill, and we don't want to repeat that. It may happen, but we've increased our mental health training across the department. We have 60% of our officers now that have been through the full week and are trained as crisis intervention officers. Also, this Friday, we have the interviews for our finalists for our mental health coordinator position. So we're actually hiring a full-time civilian that their job is to work with officers and mental health providers throughout our community to try to intercept people upstream before they get to that crisis moment. Because police officers, we meet the people that need the services, whether it's somebody that's homeless and suffering, a veteran, whether it's this weird call that we go to, or somebody that's acting a little strange on the street, we meet those people. And if we can get them tied into the services they need, we can prevent them from ever getting to that crisis downstream. Can't prevent 100%, but we can be very effective over time. And so we're moving to a full-time position, and actually I expect that person to come on within the next 45 days.
My name is Judy Candler. One of the comments that I know was made, particularly around Ferguson, is that the war on drugs really sort of changed the community and police interactions, and that you had a lot of police departments who, particularly in relation to minority communities, it became much more common for them to be raiding or kicking in doors and assuming that the people that they were interacting with were probably going to be armed. And I'm wondering if you think that's a valid statement, and how then you change the culture if that's the way that the police departments have been functioning.
Can I take that one? This is a problem. It was a problem in policing that started in the 1960s. It has become entrenched in some law enforcement cultures across the country that, we need to go out in some areas. They're usually impoverished areas with lots of minorities, and the way to solve problems is this reactive force that is put upon them. And it has been a number of decades that police departments have been reviewing those kinds of practices. Some of those have resulted in certainly death of individuals, complaints against police departments, a major president's commission coming out and saying that law enforcement is partly to blame for a lot of the rioting that has gone on in particular cities. This is particularly in the 1960s. Some departments have progressed very well in understanding that the police alone cannot solve complex problems. They cannot solve them by themselves. What we talk about here about mental illness, about substance abuse, about homelessness, these are all complex social problems that require something different than the traditional responses. So what's good news here, at least locally, are these interagency public-private law enforcement and social service responses that we can do better at this. But the idea is that there is momentum here to be collaboratively problem-solving complex problems and quit saying, for example, the police should be handling all this by themselves.
Let's take one final question.
Okay. My name is Dan Truscott. I'm a criminal defense attorney in the Valley, and I've been so for 20 years. I've represented literally thousands of people in this valley that have had interactions with the police department. I'm a little concerned that there isn't any attorney representative in your panel here today, because, talk to an attorney that's done thousands of cases and you'll get a very different perspective than what we've heard tonight.
We'll wrap up, folks, and that's the hardest part of a discussion is to end while I still see hands, but we promised we'd wrap up at 7. We're at 7:12, so Leo Morales with the ACLU, Dr. Andy Giacomazzi at Boise State University.
You had it right the first time.
I should have just stopped while I was ahead. Chief Bill Bones with the Boise Police Department and the Ada County Sheriff Captain, Steve Bartlett. We appreciate your time. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate your interest.